George Singleton of Spartanburg, South Carolina, is a storyteller who peers into human nature with a sharp wit. You Want More is his new collection of 30 short stories from 8 books over 20 years as a published author. George, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you, Ray. I'm happy to be connected to Chattanooga again.
Tell me how you got into writing.
Yeah, weird question. Weird answer coming up. You know, I was brought up in a small town in South Carolina called Greenwood. There wasn't a bookstore there. A library maybe had 15 or 20 books. You know how everybody in the South, any writer in the South always says, well, I started reading William Faulkner when I was 10 years old. And my mentor was Henry Gibson. He was on Laugh-In, this TV show Laugh-In. He came out with a big flower and said these weird poems. I thought, that guy's funny. In high school, and I wasn't a big reader, but in high school, you know, I read those things like Wuthering Heights and Charles Dickens and, you know, all those really depressing things. I thought, good golly. And when I went to college, I went to this place called Furman University. I had some professors say, hey, you might want to read this. You got a kind of weird sense of humor. And so I was reading Donald Barthelmay and John Barth and Thomas Pynchon and Eugene Ionesco, Harold Pinter, and Samuel Beckett. And I went, God, these guys are funny. Sam Beckett's not all that funny. He's kind of sad. But I think I can do this, like an idiot, you know. But then I just started writing. I don't know. I read a novel called The Sotweed Factor by John Barth that was funny, real long novel, and not particularly well known, I don't think. And I just thought, I'm going to try this. And then, because I'm real hard-headed, even when I was writing early on, I knew when things were bad, but I was going to finish it. So I'd finish and just start something else. I didn't start writing short stories until I was 28. I wrote 3 horrifically execrable novels between 21 and 28.
You had to get those out of your system.
I think so. And, you know, it came, every professor I had said, you're ready after 1,000 pages. And that first one was 450 pages. The second was 250. The third was 300. And I'm no math genius, but that comes to 1,000.
In what you write, there is tragedy, there is comedy, and there is just the downright absurd.
Yeah, I'm a little bit attracted to the absurd, and always have been since reading those playwrights. And I don't know, you know, my father had a 10th grade education. He was in the Merchant Marines, and he had some bad, he fell 45 feet into the hold of a ship. So, and he lived and had a lot of operations and a lot of hip replacements. But he lived every day like it might be the last day on earth. And he had kind of a jaundiced eye toward a lot of things. Anybody with authority, you know, anybody with a lot of money, et cetera. And that just kind of filtered into my skin somehow, I think.
And then there's the balance between those ingredients, the tragedy, the comedy, the absurd. And how do you find your way there to the right recipe?
Yeah, who knows? I just thought up this new analogy the other day. It's kind of like, I can make a meal that has an entree, sides, and all that. And sometimes, a couple, 2 or 3 times, they all work out. But a lot of times, I'm just stuck on starches. You know, I'm just going to do all starches. Or sometimes I'm just, okay, here's all the meats. But sometimes I get the meat, the starch, the vegetables, the dessert, all right. And that's the reason I write, is just trying to write a good story, you know. The tragedy comedy thing, I usually start off with a comedic premise or an absurdist premise, or, you know, a guy in a real man or woman in a really uncomfortable situation, and it might be funny, but then sometimes it just ends up being sad because they realize they cannot attain what they're trying to attain, I assume, you know, or they do attain what they're trying to attain and find out, maybe I didn't want this.
Such as the father who takes his son to visit the many ex-girlfriends that could have been his mother.
Sure. Started off, I thought, you know, I was trying to be funny. And I think that's kind of a funny premise. The father's trying to do the best he can, he thinks. The son is perplexed and just wants to give his Father's Day. And he wants to give his dad this special present, a set of hex keys or Allen wrenches. And the father's like, I really don't need anything. There's a lot of love between that father and son. But then at the end, it's just kind of, there's a sadness in that father, I think, you know, who I think is just saying, I'm a single dad doing the best I can.
And then there's the romance between the librarian and the professional bowler while they're competing to win an RV.
Yeah. Actually, that story came about because about, well, 5 years ago, my mother died. And I'm an only child. This is a mother who's from Muskegon, Michigan. And so I was left with a lot of stuff. And I didn't need or want all of it. I don't have any kids. Glenda, my wife, doesn't, you know. She took what she wanted. And I sold some estate jewelry to this place. I won't mention it. And then I was on book tour doing stuff, and the phone rang. As a matter of fact, I was going down to right below Chattanooga, like Rainesville, Alabama, or so I was going to do some kind of thing there. So the phone rang, and I answered, and Glenda said, "You're not going to be happy. Go look on the website of this jeweler where you sold the estate jewelry. Where he told you it wasn't worth any money, and he was selling it for about 10 times what he had paid me. I understand twice as much, but not 10. I let the guy know when I got back home. I said, "You know, I think you kind of cheated me a little bit. You took advantage of me." And he said, "Well, you can come back and buy it for what we paid you," which is kind. But I thought, I'd rather just write a story and just kind of make fun of you and have somebody crash an RV. And then I had to figure out how to get the RV crashed into the place. You know, I had to work that story kind of backwards.
Back into it.
Yeah. No pun intended.
What do you think people miss? What do you think people get wrong about the South when we're talking about the literature of the South?
Yeah. Well, some people think that Southern literature is all grandma in the rocking chair on the front porch spinning tales. And that may have been 50 to 100 years ago. Southern literature is really diverse, more than people think. And you have kind of these little, you know, you got the Appalachian literature, Appalachian noir. You got low country literature. You got that deep South literature of Mississippi, Alabama. I don't know. I think basically any writer worth his or her salt is just trying to tell a story that people could in the Pacific Northwest or New England could say, "Oh yeah, that rings a bell to me too." Even though if it's Maine, somebody in Maine and someone's writing a story that involves high school football and barbecue and deer hunting, person in Maine might say, "Yeah, that sounds a lot like here, except it's hockey, moose, I don't know what they eat, and clam chowder." Yeah.
That sounds right. I've been there.
I had to pull that one out, Ray. That was a tough one to come up with off the top of my head.
We got past the finish line. That's all right. What you write about and the way you write it, the people that you focus on, these characters, there's really no such thing as a minor character. They might seem minor on that first sentence, that first paragraph, that first page, but where you take them and what that reveals about them, nothing minor about that.
You're the second person that's told me this, and especially about this book. Maybe a month ago, someone said something about these minor characters are not minor. And I've never thought about it. I mean, they're secondary characters, but you know, if they're in the story, they need to have some importance. You can't just have someone show up and then walk off stage immediately. They have to do something to help drive the narrative forward, you know, I hope.
And these characters, they are from the South. They are blue-collar men and women. They're just struggling to make sense of the world and struggling to live their lives.
Yeah, a lot of times I'll have blue-collar characters who are educated or a little bit more liberal than, let's say, the average South Carolinian, and just trying to make sense out of the world. I mean, that's, you know, that's what we should all be doing. I mean, and I don't want to bring politics up because it only gets me in trouble, but I'm kind of having a hard time making sense of the world right now. I think everybody else is. It's real hard to write humor. Talk about trying to write comedy. With all the absurdity going on, I don't have anything to write about except read the newspaper.
Even Will Rogers might have been challenged by today.
I think Will Rogers would have just gone off into the sunset, you know, gone and retired in Missouri or wherever.
Do you have any favorites among the stories in this collection?
I'm not being coy. When I write a story and send it off, and let's say it might get rejected 10 times or might get accepted, I kind of forget about it after it's already published or in a book. But so a lot of times someone will say to me, "You remember?" So I'm just praying, Ray, that you don't mention some character. And I go, "I don't know what you're talking about." But that story, Show and Tell, it's another dad and lad story. It's about a father who keeps giving his son these things to take to show and tell in the third grade or whatever, and just keeps doing it. And what they end up being is the kid's teacher is the father's ex-girlfriend from high school. And the reason why I like that story is because I wrote that in about 1999 or 2000, so I was already 40, 42. It was a big shift. It was a first-person retrospective. It was an adult narrator looking back and saying, you know, when I was 8 years old, I had this crazy father. And I really enjoyed telling those stories because I kind of have a lot from my own life. They're just fun to write. And so I remember that one because it seemed to be a breakthrough in voice, for one. You know, no one wants to hear a story from a six-year-old kid written like a six-year-old kid or five-year-old kid. Me want a lollipop. Five-year-old probably wouldn't talk like that. But it's easy. You can, in this first-person retrospective, you use adult language, except maybe in dialogue. But the kid might say, and then I said to my dad, I know you're doing something, you're up to something wrong, Dad, but I'll go ahead with it. He can't use some big word. I mean, a six-year-old can't say, I know you're doing something horrifically terrible, Father. Ergo, I'm going to go along with it. You can't talk like that, but you get to do a mixture.
Who do you keep going back to read?
I get about six or eight. So there's another thing that really changed for me is Flannery O'Connor. I did not read, you know, when those three novels I was talking to you about earlier that was just god awful. One was set in Nice, France, because I'd spent 10 days in Nice, France. And one was set in Washington, D.C., because I'd spent 9 months there. One was set in Memphis, Tennessee. I'd never even been to Memphis, but I had a map of the place. So I would just say, Beale Street seems kind of important. And I kept having people say, you know, George, no offense, but you keep writing about these places you don't really know about. You're from a small ex-cotton mill town in South Carolina. Write about small towns. And I thought, nothing exciting could happen in small towns. What could happen? And then I started reading Flannery O'Connor. I was not an English major in college. I've studied philosophy. I'm still lagging in my reading. But when I read Flannery O'Connor, is that, oh man, now I get it. You know, when you read all her, think about all, she only lived to be 39, all those great stories. So there's her. Oddly enough, the other is a Northeastern writer named John Cheever. John Cheever, he wrote some odd experimental short stories like The Enormous Radio, The Swimmer. I have a story in this collection about a guy in The Swimmer, I forget his name, Nettie Merrill maybe, swims home through pool after pool after pool in his neighborhood across the county. And I have a guy who gets on his riding lawnmower and cuts the swath across the county in his riding lawnmower because he's dead. He's just riding on it dead till he crashes into a silo and people are, oh, you know. So I was kind of doing a little metafiction thing there. But John Cheever can figure out how to go from point A to point C. You know, a lot of times I'll go, okay, I need to get over here somewhere, but I don't know how to do it. I'll go back and read John Cheever. You know, I'll go read Country Husband or that Enormous Radio. I think it's great. Oddly enough, John Cheever, I'm pointing here, for 3 months lived about 1 mile from where I'm sitting right now because he was stationed in Spartanburg at Camp Croft Army Base back in the 40s. In his biography, it was about a one-page section. Actually, he wrote a letter home and said Spartanburg was a town filled with wild razorbacks and people so lazy they won't go to a free parade on Sunday. For language, for just like, just utter, man, how does that guy write a sentence? It's a guy named Barry Hanna, who's passed away, but it was down in Mississippi. He's another go-to guy. Guy said I had six or eight. Off the top of my head, those are like the three that I can just go to. Yeah.
What about younger writers in this region? Who has caught your eye? Who do you pay attention to?
I'm going to have to tiptoe around this one. I just read a book by a woman named Leia Hampton. She lives in Western North Carolina. It's one of the best books of short stories I've read in a long time. I think the title is great, but I can't say it on radio. Well, if you go to your bookstore, you just say, hey, can I get this? And say it. But I think if you're trying to order it online, you might have to actually use that asterisk. But it is a great story. Every first sentence of that is just plows ahead. I mean, it's great. There's a guy down in New Orleans, but he's from Mississippi, named M.O. Walsh. His name's Neil Walsh, but he goes by M.O. Walsh. And he, I don't know how old Neil is. He's 30s. And I think his new novel's called The Big Door Prize. It's not out yet. Oh, there's a ton. And I get embarrassed because I read them and I go, you know, I'm always thinking, oh, they're going to be writing stories about technology or TikTok or something that I just don't understand or care about, and they don't. A buddy of mine, David Joy. David Joy is also from Western North Carolina, And his new book is called, I think it's called When These Mountains Burn. He's written The Weight of the World. He's putting out a novel a year. And he's writing in this Appalachian noir kind of style, not detective stories, but they're also just good blue collar mountain people doing the best they can with what they got, living in crystal meth kind of area, you know. I still consider Silas House young, so I'll put him in there too.
I don't think he'll argue with you.
Silas is young, you know.
Where can people go online to follow everything that you do beyond this collection?
I hate to say it, but you'd look on Amazon. I think I've got about 11, I think I got 11 or 12 books. I've kind of forgotten. I'm not being weird about that. Two of them are novels. They're not good novels. As a matter of fact, one is called Novel. And it's about a guy named Novel. That's his name. And he's writing a long poem. And I did it kind of as a joke. Back then I was with this publishing house called Harcourt. And I was kind of being urged to write a novel. Maybe I was drinking a little bit too much back then, Ray. But I thought, all right, a novel. I'm going to call it Novel and blah, blah, blah. And it's a hairy, metafictional. You kind of need to know some stuff about James Joyce, oddly enough, to maybe understand some of the allusions. Then I wrote a kind of normal novel called Work Shirts for Mad Men. But short stories are kind of my thing, you know. For these crazy Zoom virtual book signing things, I would go to hubcity.com. I'm not very good at self-PR, whatever that is. I kind of hate it. I kind of want to just hide, you know, and write my stuff and just go hide. But that's not the way of the world. It hasn't been for many. If I sold 1,000,000 books, I could do that. I could be J.D. Salinger, but it looks like that ain't going to happen.
Not yet, anyway.
never.
All right. George, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ray. I really enjoyed talking to you.